Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
It's been about 15 years since I first talked with Justin A. Frank, M.D. He is the D.C.-based psychiatrist who first wrote Bush on the Couch, then Obama on the Couch, and in my hand right now I'm holding his latest, Trump on the Couch, Inside the Mind of the President. And we'll spend an hour with Dr. Frank today talking about what's inside of the mind of Donald Trump. There's a lot to talk about, and you might want to think that he's just crazy. But he's narcissistic, he's misogynistic, he's racist, he's a guy who doesn't know the truth. And of course, Dr. Frank has better words than I do. He's a trained psychoanalyst, and I found his new book rather informative, as I do all of our conversations. And as we talk with Dr. Frank, we will unveil the new bonus gift for subscribers to the Peter B. Collins podcast. Thanks to those who support my work, and thanks to you for listening to today's podcast. Dr. Justin A. Frank returns to the Peter B. Collins podcast. We've been pals for years since he published Bush on the Couch. Then we really learned a lot from each other when he published Obama on the Couch. And now, Trump on the Couch has arrived.
I think you're gonna like it.
Inside the Mind of the President.
I think you're gonna feel you belong.
You're gonna feel that you belong? Dr. Frank has published these three books, and I've enjoyed many conversations with him over the past few years. And we always begin with an important disclaimer. Dr. Justin Frank has never met Donald J. Trump. He doesn't have access to any other psychiatric information about him. He has read widely in the public record Trump's own books and done a substantive investigation into his family history. But he does not purport to be practicing his skill here, his craft of on-the-couch psychiatry. Is that a fair disclaimer, Dr. Frank?
Yes, that's a fair disclaimer, although there is a tradition within which I am practicing, which is called applied psychoanalysis, which really was started also by Freud, and it was aimed at everything you're saying, but using analytic principles for people who you can't get in your consulting room, usually famous people or historical figures or even occasionally fictional figures.
And was this more difficult for you to write than Bush on the Couch or Obama on the Couch?
Yes, it was more difficult for two reasons. There's very little information, particularly about his mother and about their relationship. And it all begins with the mother, as I write in my book and as we all know in our lives. So that was one thing that made it very difficult. And the other thing was the massive flood of material and information that came tweeting out. I felt really almost drowned in it. So I had to retreat from it and pick about six or seven psychological categories to write about after I wrote more of the psychobiography of him. So the book is really in two parts. The first part is about his childhood, mother, father, brother, and his rivals. And the second part is about his major pathologies. And that's really was how to define those was a problem. It raised a problem. But, you know, there's lying, there's destructiveness, there's narcissism, there's speech difficulties, there's learning disabilities. There's a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
So it felt like a little bit more than in the other book.
And if he were to present himself to you for psychotherapy, how long would you estimate you would engage?
Well, first of all, he's the kind of person who, if he didn't like what I said, he would get up and leave.
Yeah.
Which is how he dealt with press conferences, when people would say something he didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the first thing. The second thing is he would demand to see me whenever he felt like it. So he'd be the kind of person who'd be knocking on my door when I was with another patient, and then when I would go to see him, he would say, I don't want to see you now. And I think that is really who he is. And so he is a master at being evasive, at avoiding things. So I don't think he would ever commit. He certainly would not lie down on my couch because he couldn't bear that somebody was out of his visual field.
Well,
I sit behind my patients when I'm in the consulting room.
But it might mess up his hair thing, too.
Well, that's another reason completely. I'd have to make special efforts to make a soft pillow for him and everything to make sure his hair was okay.
Did you ever see, it was in the 80s, a really bad B-movie that starred Dan Aykroyd? It was called The Couch Trip. And he was a mental patient, and he broke out of this facility and then impersonated his shrink. And in that role, he addressed a conference of fellow doctors. And I remember one quote from it. He said, you know, we believe that therapy should take a long time. He said, you know, why do something quickly that you could do over a long period of time?
Exactly. As the goal of a first session is to get a second session.
Uh-huh. And before we dive into the book, can we spend a moment on the cover art? Who drew this for you?
Well, I love this cover art. It's by Barry Blitt, B-L-I-T-T, I think, who is one of the main cartoonists who does covers for The New Yorker.
Mm.
And he's done a series of wonderful cartoons about Trump over the last couple of years. They're really quite powerful and amazing.
And if I can manage to, I'm going to put a rendition of the cover art into the text file that accompanies this podcast.
Yes, that would be great, because it really is a great cover.
Without ruining it, it shows Trump's head occupying the entire couch.
Yes, occupying the entire couch right on the front page. What I found out that was interesting, however, and I don't know about your listeners and the demographics, but one of the things I found out is that a lot of people don't understand what on the couch means anymore.
Really?
Yes, and I was really shocked about it, but a couple of people told me afterwards, after the book came out, that they've been at meetings with other friends and younger people who were millennials and different people, and they were talking about the book, and several people said, well, what does it mean on the couch?
Wow.
So people really don't know. I just assumed it's in the popular culture about psychoanalysis and using the couch, but I found that really interesting. I don't know where to go with it.
Well, then we'll close caption this for younger listeners. The couch refers to the place where the patient sits or lies while he or she unloads to the psychiatrist.
Exactly. Perfect.
Well, Dr. Frank, what I'd like to do is delve into part two of your book, the pathology section, and invite you to add some of the key history that you developed in the first section of the book.
Sure.
And first, I would offer an observation that wasn't explicitly detailed in your book, and that is that Trump is a highly insecure individual. And we're going to detail some of the characteristics that comprise that insecurity. But fundamentally, he always operates on offense because the best defense is a good offense.
Yes.
And in order to keep people from probing his weaknesses, from identifying his learning disorders, from relating to the lies that he tells and, you know, simply not trusting him, he's the kind of guy who always dominates an exchange with people, and he keeps on the offense, including using insults and name-calling, in order to dominate the scene and to try to throw his adversaries or interlocutors off balance.
Yes, that's exactly the case. And for him, it's always seemed to work. It puts people back on their heels. And in fact, when he was in his first series of debates in the Republican nomination race with all those 16 other opponents, a couple of people, one of whom is the guy who wrote the cartoon Dilbert, I forget his name, but he said that Trump is like, these Republicans are like bringing, you know, sticks and stones to a person with a howitzer,
mm-hmm.
That he will destroy them. And he was right. I didn't really see that exactly. But he is amazingly powerful and compelling. He uses a form of what I call a defensive use of contempt, which dovetails with your thought about his being insecure. He has contempt for other people as a way of covering over his own anxiety and his own insecurity. So he becomes better than them, and then he's able to fight by using his contempt as a weapon. So he would put down people with, you know, all of his different nicknames, you know, Low Energy and Crooked mm-hmm. Hillary and all the different
Lion
nicknames.
Ted.
He used Lion Ted, mm-hmm. all of those things. And that's how he would put people down. It's very interesting that he's like, in a way, like George Bush on steroids, because George Bush also used to make nicknames for people and put people down with nicknames. And I really think that that has something to do with both of them, their ability to speak and think and read and deal with certain kinds of learning problems. But
aren't they also juvenile tactics from being sent to boarding school?
Yes, they're definitely related to boarding school. Both of them were sent to boarding school. They're both very juvenile, like kind of locker room, you know, towel snapping
right.
tactics that boys use against each other.
I did like Bush's nickname for Karl Rove, Turd Blossom.
Turd Blossom was the best one ever. I love that one. And the one thing that when Trump was debating those guys in all the Republicans, there was one moment where Trump can be very funny, I think, and when he's, you know, really on, you know, he's really on and, mm-hmm. and pleased. They were talking about their mothers and influence, how their mothers influenced them, and Jeb Bush was waxing ecstatic about how great Barbara was, what a wonderful mother, and what a thoughtful person, and was politically committed. And all of a sudden, Trump interrupts and says, well, why doesn't she run? I love that.
But part of the appeal there was the rudeness. And
yes.
he does feel that the rules don't apply to him.
Right.
And everybody else is supposed to be deferential and, you know, respect him. He demands upward loyalty but doesn't return it. And so everything is really one way with him. Everything is centered around him.
Yes, that's true. I think that that's also, as much as that's true about his grandiosity, and there's a chapter in the chapter on narcissism that I write about, it's also true that that's the source of his appeal to many people, because so many of the people he appeals to have always felt in one way or another that they have been doing the right thing, that they do pay their taxes, they do go to church, they do work hard, they do try to make ends meet. And they are losing ground all the time and feeling ignored. And they also obey the rules. They're like overtly polite, and they only swear when they're locked in their cars, swearing at some other driver. But the rest of the time, they're well-behaved and proper and respectful overtly. And I think that Trump breaks through that, and he gives people permission to say what they feel, to not have to be self-conscious about it, to just go ahead and attack people. And I think that he has tapped into that need, and that's one of the sources of his appeal even to business people, too, because he's so opposed to regulation, and regulation means rules and things you have to obey, and he can't stand those things.
And if I can amplify or just kind of edge up your comment there, I think he not only gives permission, he gives license to people who think hateful thoughts to blurt them out.
Yes.
And Dr. Frank, my first contact with this phenomenon was the dubious honor I had of spending 3 years on the radio in San Francisco following Rush Limbaugh's program every day.
Oh, my God.
And
poor thing.
He did this. He started by making fun of Jesse Jackson and homeless people.
Yep.
And, you know, over time, he expanded it. And I had one interview where he was at our station for a week, and I interviewed Limbaugh for an hour.
Ooh.
And I asked him, I said, you know, Rush, you're a pretty funny guy, but your targets are all on the left. I said, haven't you ever seen Ronald Reagan be the source of humor? You know, Poppy Bush said all sorts of silly things. And he just cut me off. And he said, well, he said, I'm here to defend and to protect Reagan. And
exactly.
And he only, you know, he pivoted in a way that I think is similar to Trump, that he only talks to his base. He doesn't attempt to widen out and appeal to people who might only occasionally agree with him. He, and I'm referring here to Limbaugh, but Trump as well, they rely on the love, loyalty, and adulation of a narrow group of people who they can count on to agree with them 90% or more of the time. And in pursuit of that romance, if you will, they basically write off the rest of the population.
But I think that you're right. I think that not only do they write them off, that there's also a degree of clarity about the what he said to you is also very clear about his political point of view and his hatred of the left. I really think that that's another part that gets lost. I mean, I think that one of the biggest problems in the 2016 election and in general with the Democratic Party is that for years they've underestimated the degree to which they're hated by the people like the people in Trump's base and by many in the Republican Party. And I think that Limbaugh taps in to hate, and he does give license to attack and to mock and to make fun, especially of the downtrodden. Now, as a psychoanalyst, which I happen to be, the one thing that is involved in mocking the downtrodden or the minorities is that it's a what is projected or what is put into these people by Limbaugh is a fears of defective parts of himself, of weakness, of inadequacy, of whether it's not being able to stand up to his father or whatever. So he puts them into other people and then attacks them for being weak and inadequate, which is a projection. And you could see this with Bush, and when Barbara Bush was mocking all those people who were in the Superdome because of Katrina and how they were better fed than they've ever been and all those things, the contempt was dripping. But it really is a contempt that's based on a projected part of themselves. I don't know if I'm explaining this correctly.
Oh, you are.
Clearly. And they take a part of themselves, like the pot calling the kettle black. They put something that they disavow, that they don't like in themselves, afraid of being weak, or if, you know, if I have a limp or whatever it is, I put it into somebody else and then attack them.
I just dug up this clip from Limbaugh. I think this is the right one, so I'll play this for you.
Why don't you, a caller mentioned this to you one time, make fun of John Sununu, Dan Quayle, Ronald Reagan is a guy who, even if you love him, is a caricature who can be the source of humor. Why do you stay away from those people and simply drive piles into Ted Kennedy?
Well, please don't try to make a moral equivalence here between Kennedy and Reagan or Kennedy and Quayle.
They're public figures. You're a funny guy.
But why
do you only find humor in the icons of the left?
Well, in all honesty here, it's because I love Reagan, and I very much appreciate what he stood for. And I am sick and tired of the ceaseless, ending character assassination and malignment that this man has received. And I don't need to add to it. I need to defend it. People say that what I do is attack my targets. And I don't do that, Peter. I get up and read the newspaper like everybody else, and I looked at who is attacking somebody. The militant environmentalists are trying to attack the timber industry. Militant vegetarians are attacking the beef industry. So I simply respond. I defend.
Now, Dr. Frank, isn't this a perfect case study of projection?
Yes, it is. It's textbook. And he's the one who is always doing the attacking, and then he then accuses anybody who criticizes something that he likes as attacking. So he projects his attacking into anybody who says anything that raises a question about what it means or anything that might be negative. They are attacking.
He also presents himself as the nation's leading expert on the virulent virus called liberalism.
Yes.
And it is so laughable. I force myself to listen to this guy for at least 10 or 15 minutes a day. And it's how I learned, for example, that he declared jihad on Ralph Northam, the governor of Virginia, over abortion legislation 6 hours before the Klan and blackface photo was leaked by a right-wing website. And I haven't heard anybody else in mainstream media make the connection that Northam is the victim of a very calculated political attack. And, you know, this is the kind of power that Limbaugh has, and it is fundamentally based on projection.
Yes. I think you're right on the money. There are some people who are talking about linking the attacks on Northam with his comments about late-term abortion.
Yes.
So some people are talking about that, but they're not talking about it as clearly and as explicitly as you just did.
Right.
Yours is very clear.
They talk about it in passing as a controversy that preceded the surfacing of these photos, but they don't connect them as cause and effect.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's a huge problem. In fact, one of the things that but that's so immediate, that cause and effect. A lot of people don't connect the dots between cause and effect after a few weeks. They don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were studies that were done in the counterterrorism group in the State Department that used to that realized that people don't remember things beyond 3 weeks in terms of making links between events. So they would always research terrorists online and things who would be communicating with each other where there was a 4 week gap or more between communications. And because most people would not pay attention to those things or make links.
Yeah. And just as another example of Trump's projection, he has blamed repeatedly Democrats for his decision and Jeff Sessions' implementation of the zero-tolerance policy at the border that produced child separation.
Right.
Go ahead.
That is a very clear example of projection. What it is also clear, though, is the more I've looked into it, and especially in the chapter I wrote about his destructiveness, which was called destructiveness, actually, one of the things that I realized, even after the chapter was published, was that he hates mothers. That he has to attack the relationship between a mother and a baby. And that it's very deep and it's very profound. So at one level, we're talking about projection, which is what you're talking about and what we're talking about. But at another level, part of the sources of that projection has to do with a very deep-seated hatred of women, of mothers, of happy families, of deep connections, because he doesn't have any.
Well, and you point out in the book that shortly after his third wife gave birth, he's out there with Stormy Daniels and with the Playboy Playmate. And he has a very serious case of the Madonna whore complex, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. But I think that it's not just the Madonna whore complex. It's the hatred of Madonna. The Madonna whore complex was about men who were impotent with their wives and could only be excited by prostitutes because their wives reminded them too much of a mother figure and the taboos of incest.
Mm-hmm.
I really think that for Trump, it's much more profound. He really hates mothers. He is a very anti-mother person. He hates that they invite people to need them, that they can do things by nursing a baby and by giving life to a child that he can't do. Those are things he just can't do. And he really envies them and hates them. He can't stand that anybody can do something he can't do. And you see it coming out in other forms, like, I have the best knowledge, I know more about ISIS and the generals, I'm the smartest this, I'm the best this. And he really means it. He's not just bragging. He actually believes it, I think, about himself. That's why you can call him insecure, and I agree with you completely, and that at one level, he's grandiose and maniacal in terms of thinking he can do everything. You can see both parts of him.
Now, staying with the misogyny here for a moment, it's curious that in recent weeks he has struggled because he has nicknames for other people,
right,
but
Nancy.
He lost the battle over the shutdown to Speaker Pelosi, and he says, well, I call her Nancy.
Right.
Now, first of all, he should be calling her Madam Speaker if he observes formalities. And at the State of the Union, he was supposed to be introduced by the Speaker, and he blew right past it. And then he led a standing O for Melania and failed to do the ritual recognition of the Speaker.
Right. So that's how he deals with Nancy Pelosi. He does try to put her down, but he's not going to go to a nickname level. So he calls her by a first name, which is his version of putting her down. It's like if you and I just met and I was going to be a guest on your program as Dr. Frank, you wouldn't just walk up and say, hey, Jesse, how you doing?
Right.
Having never met me. But that's what Trump does as a way of putting the other person down or putting them on the defensive. And so I think that even when he says he's not having a nickname, he calls her Nancy, that is a way of, as you say, not calling her Madam Speaker or not recognizing who she is. And I do think he does that because he's afraid of her.
Mm-hmm.
I do think he's been afraid of her from the get-go. And he's afraid of women that he can't seduce, so he has to put them down. And he's afraid of older women, of women who can see through him. He cannot stand it.
So what's the deal with Ivanka?
Oh, boy. What isn't the deal? He loves Ivanka because Ivanka is the female part of himself. Ivanka is the most beautiful, idealized self, only it's a woman. And so she is... Now my dog is crying to get out of the room.
Okay.
Is that what you want to do, Teddy?
Go ahead. Let Teddy out.
I'm going to open the door for him because he feels that he wants to go outside, but I know once he's out. You know why doors are important for dogs?
Why?
They're always interested on what's on the other
side.
Yes,
they are.
So he'll be back here in a few minutes. But anyway, I don't know what else to say about Ivanka. I mean, he actually, it's a little bit like, I forgot to get all these different mythic figures, but he's like Galatea, who was molded in the form of exact form of the most desirable, perfect woman. And I think that he did that with Ivanka. She said breast implants and all kinds of plastic surgery by the time she was 16 or 17.
Mm-hmm.
That's well documented, and it has to do with wanting her to be perfect. And he even talked about his next child, the next woman, Tiffany, her breasts, and he said, we don't know what she's going to look like. He made a comment when she was a baby about it. He's very concerned with this, and he notices it all the time.
And,
I don't know what to say about it, but it freaks people out.
Some of this surfaces from his frequent and lengthy psychoanalysis sessions with Dr. Howard Stern.
Yes.
Where, you know, they're trying to outdo each other, similar to the Access Hollywood tape.
Yes.
With sexist commentary. And one of the things you point out in the book that really, you know, resonated with me, Dr. Frank, is that Trump has a need, and this gets back to boarding school, to get away with things.
Yes.
Like saying, you know, grab him by the pussy, and, you know, maybe he actually has done that, but bragging about it, talking about it, the idea of it, and the offensiveness, the, you know, bad boy, rule-bending aspects of it, that's what gives him the real rush, isn't it?
Yes. What gives him the rush is being delinquent, is breaking things, is getting away with things, is bragging about destroying other people's boundaries and other people's autonomy. He can't stand people who are not paying attention to him, who are autonomous, and he has to break them down. I'm not sure if I'm exactly responding to what you said, but he clearly, this all fits with hatred of rules, hatred of limits, hatred of regulations. The person who lays down the rules in most families, and traditionally in this country, is supposedly the father.
Mm-hmm.
And in his case, his father really did lay down the rules. And what happened in the family, and where this delinquency part of Trump is so great, is his father laid down the rules, and Donald didn't obey them. He secretly snuck into New York and bought switchblade knives without his father's knowledge. His father forbid him to go into Manhattan when he was in the fifth grade, sixth grade, seventh grade. He would sneak in. And eventually the father discovered it, and that's when he sent him off to boarding school. And what's important about that is that the father, for all of his problems as being a tyrant and a difficult man, could recognize that he couldn't cope. He was saying, I cannot raise this boy. I have to get help. I have to send him to a military school. I cannot do it myself. He tried every way he could, really, because he was very focused on wanting Donald to be the superstar, killer, king, everything, but what he raised was a delinquent.
And you observe, I want to make it clear, you're not diagnosing, but your observation is that Trump suffers from dyslexia.
Yes.
How far back do we have indication of learning difficulties in school?
Well, first of all, there is some history about that. He was always in detention. He would hit a teacher in the second grade, but before that, he could not pay attention and not sit still. So he would be called, by modern nomenclature, ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. The emphasis in his case would be on the H, the hyperactivity, because he cannot sit still. And one of the things that happens when people are wired this way is that they can't sit still and they can't take in information. So it's not clear about reading, because it's not clear that they can sit still long enough to read, because he does read off of the teleprompter. I don't know that he understands anything he's saying, but has learned to be able to read that way. But he is really unable to study, to take time to think. He is a keen observer, and he's very smart about making the most out of an opportunity, thinking about land, thinking about investment, thinking about the future. But he is not really able to sit back and actually absorb and think. And he has a form of dyslexia that involves not being able to process information that he not only that he reads, but that he hears. It's a form of what's called alexithymia, which is an inability to really make sense out of words. And this started very early. I am sure of it. I am sure as I could possibly be, that if I got to know Mary Trump, his mother, and asked her to describe her different pregnancies, my guess is that she would have described her pregnancy with Donald as being one of having a baby who was always kicking inside. Hmm. And my guess is that he was hyperactive from birth.
And so, we've recently heard that I'm sorry?
That's a guess. I can't know that, but that's my guess.
Understood.
He's hyperactive from birth.
So recently we've learned that he spends as much as 60% of his workday on what they euphemistically call executive time.
Right.
Which is when he watches Fox News and tweets.
Right.
And so, with the background you just offered about learning difficulties, is television the most effective way for him to learn and absorb information?
Yes, it is. But what would happen, what they'd have to do is that if, let's say, Fox News suddenly put on Rachel Maddow and started talking about something that he didn't want to know, he would just change the channels. So there would have to be not only the news for him to learn information, he would have to have the same news on every channel, because his ability to not hear what he doesn't want to hear has become so fine-tuned over the years that he will not listen to things and will not believe them. He really did think that his crowd at the inauguration was bigger than Obama's. I mean, I really do think he thought that. Hmm. That's what's so disturbing about him. It's not only that he lies, but that it affects his actual perceptual apparatus. So when you're talking and asking about learning disabilities, executive time for him is a time to completely just let go and tweet and go channel surfing and become addicted the way kids who have ADD or ADHD spend a tremendous amount of time in their own room with their phone or switching channels and watching TV or YouTube. It's really quite common for ADD children to be focused on their phone, on their television, and they just sit there and they're mesmerized because they can take in things that they see, but then they quickly go to something else. So like the way movies have jump cuts and jump from one thing to another, it's very much fits with the physiological and neurological wiring of these people. And there are a lot of people like that. They run on what I call digital time. They go from one thing to the next without really thinking in terms of the analog or the big picture or the sweeping second hand on a clock. They actually just, everything is sound bites and bite size, and very much like an infant who, when you see an infant cry, you have the sense that it never remembered that it ever laughed. And then when it's laughing, you can't imagine it having ever cried, because they disconnect these feelings so much, because they're not able to neurologically connect them until they're at least 6 months old, and when they start to be able to make connections inside themselves. And I think Trump just doesn't do, he's like that as an adult. I mean, other leaders are like that. I knew somebody who worked for Bill Gates and said that it was like he would just come in and say, today we're going to do something else. So everybody's working on the new thing, he says. And then the next day he'd come in and say, today we're going to do this. And people who are smart, which Trump I don't think is smart in that way, can also do that. They change directions, they get an idea, they follow it, and then if they don't like it, they'll do something else. I don't know how to respond. There are some executives who do have similar qualities to Trump. They're not cruel or the way he is, and not as angry and as need to kind of compensate for inadequacies. They've accepted who they are, and this is how they function.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we chewed on the last time you and I talked was his curious phrase that he's used many times, and I'm going to say it verbatim. I'm like really smart. And he always inserts the like there, as if it's a form of humility that softens the braggadocio of saying just flat out, I'm really smart. But it really seems to infect his self-image, his perception of himself. And he does think that he knows it all, that he knows more than the generals and more than the intelligence officials, and knows more about trivial things than the people who are experts on them. So it is kind of an interesting form of projection there, where he is telling himself how smart he is at the same time he's trying to impress the rest of us.
Yes, it's a form of a pause for him to think, I'm like really smart. It's a way of stopping to reassure himself that he is really smart, and he's saying it to himself first, and then he says it to us. I think that's a really astute observation, and I remember us talking about that. I think your point is really well taken, that it is a form of self-assurance. I mean, I'm just suddenly thinking about how, while we're talking, I think is when he's doing his rally in El Paso, or maybe that's in another hour.
It's coming up this evening, yeah.
Ah, coming up. But that's where he can completely fuse with his base. The people have an emotional connection that is so deep and so profound that you can't tell where he is and where he ends and where they begin. So there he doesn't have to say, I'm like the smartest. He can just say whatever he thinks.
Well,
doesn't have to convince anybody.
And these mob rallies, which, by the way, after the Kavanaugh confirmation imbroglio, he turned the tables in the most dramatic projection we had seen, and he addressed his pre-election mob rallies in red states across the country.
Yes.
And told them to fear the Democratic mob that had just tried to block this great American, Brett Kavanaugh, from being confirmed to the Supreme Court because of some floozy, you know, some lying bitch. And it is just stunning how he is able to manage the reality of at least his Twitter followers.
Well, it is stunning, and they really do believe him because he tapped into some part of them. It's a form of imprinting. He tapped into some very primitive, and primitive meaning early in life, need to have somebody who could make sense of their world, who was an authority figure, who could help them manage the unmanageable. And I think that somehow he tapped into this, and so people forgive him for the content, and he just goes ahead and goes on the attack. But what you're also describing and what he did after the Kavanaugh hearings was it's a form of displacement, not just projection.
Mm-hmm.
He was displacing Stormy Daniels and McDougal and all these other women onto
Blasey Ford?
Onto Blasey Ford.
Mm-hmm.
So he could really talk about how she's framing Kavanaugh and the Democrats are framing Kavanaugh, but it's a displacement of his own anxiety about being framed and why he's had to pay people off so they wouldn't ever talk about Stormy Daniels.
So
he displaces. And it's not just he projects, and he also gets rid of some persecuting inner person and puts it into somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Now, I would describe him as a compulsive, profligate, and careless liar.
Yes.
And the fact checkers, particularly at the Washington Post, show that when he hosts these mob rallies is when he lies the most. As much as 70% of what he says is flat-out bullshit.
Yes.
And, Dr. Frank, this is where I have a problem, because I don't believe that everybody who puts on a red Make America Great hat lowers their IQ by 40 points when they do that. But anyone who attends one of these rallies has to identify at least one statement uttered by Trump as false, misleading, or at minimum exaggerated.
But they dismiss it.
And that should be the tip-off that you can't trust anything else that he says.
But that's because you're a scientist. not that you really are,
yeah.
but you're taking a scientific approach. As a psychoanalyst, I could be not accused, but I have been, of let me just give you an example. We had a real debate with this scientist years ago who hated psychoanalysis, and he told me, Sir Karl Popper, famous guy, he said, if we're sitting here and suddenly the glass of water next to us would start rising up off the table, I would have to doubt the entire theory of gravity. And you, as a psychoanalyst, would just find a way to fold it into your theory. Made me laugh. And I think that that's what happens with Trump's audience. They will fold whatever he says so they can see him lying, and it doesn't matter.
Well, and let me cite the work of my other favorite Washington-based guy named Frank, Tom Frank. He's the guy who wrote the book What's the Matter with Kansas,
exactly.
where he showed how you can dangle, revoking abortion rights over a certain group of people, and they'll allow you to raise their taxes and shut their schools and do all kinds of things.
That's right.
As long as they, believe the carrot that is being dangled. So, but we're into this over 2 years now, and shouldn't some of those people be figuring this out?
But he wrote this book, Tom Frank, about George Bush.
Yes.
So this was happening way before Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Trump is a more extreme version of George Bush. So this has always been a wish that people have to believe in Santa Claus or something that they don't ever want to have disproved.
All right. But what about the God Squad people? Okay. For God's sake, we have all of these preachers and bishops and other religious figures who are sitting still for some of the most immoral personal behavior and political behavior that we have seen of a public figure in our lifetimes.
That's right.
And yet, because he vows to end abortion, they're going to stick with him. They don't
yes.
care, who he's been shtupping and,
right.
That he's misogynist and talks about Hillary
nope.
getting schlonged or any of that stuff.
No, nope. Does not matter. Because what matters is some idea that is a principle that overrides everything else. And this has always been the way it is. I mean, we've had the Crusades hundreds of years ago. People really are willing to just slaughter other people, destroy them in the name of a cause. And it's always been that way, potentially, in all of us human beings, because there's a wish to not be anxious, to be certain. And so once they're certain about something, which for some reason is abortion, I'm assuming, I really have not done a psychoanalytic study of people who are against abortion so profoundly. But it would be an interesting thing, and you're helping me think about doing it, because it seems like it doesn't make sense, because in the unconscious, what we've discovered in psychoanalytic work is that many children have a wish to scoop out the insides of their mothers and get rid of all future rivals and have a deep fantasy of wanting to never have another rival come along. And that's deeply unconscious, and that's been discovered by several child analysts who've written extensively about this fantasy. And you see it in adults where, let's say, a woman will clean up her house immaculately before her mother comes to visit, because her mother doesn't want her mother to see her messiness or anything that's messy, because that would activate in the person whose mother is visiting some fantasies that they have. They don't want to be discovered, that they would have liked to mess up the inside of their mother's body. So I don't know what the relationship between people who are so adamant against abortion and why that might be a reaction against some other impulse. I have no idea. I would be very curious to start thinking about that.
My guest is Dr. Justin A. Frank. His new book is Trump on the Couch, Inside the Mind of the President. And I have a special announcement for our listeners. Every day I like to mention some of the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. People like Real Life Americans, Cliff Johnson, Susan Gavay, Johnny Jump, and hundreds of other people. And I would like to invite you to join their ranks. You can take out a subscription. Just visit peterbcollins.com, find the menu button, click on that, and then you click on Become a Subscriber. You'll land on the sign-up page. And as soon as I get around to it, I will be posting our new bonus offer for new annual subscribers. Dr. Frank's publisher has given us 5 copies of Trump on the Couch, and the first 5 people who take out an annual subscription and cough up a mailing address in the continental U.S. because I can't ship overseas, you will get the book. And Dr. Frank, I want to thank you for arranging this, and I'd love to get your book into the hands of some of my smart and activist listeners.
I'm very excited about your offer, and I do think it's a great thing you're doing, and I actually think, I know, in fact, that people who've read the book really found it helpful in thinking about Trump, thinking about themselves, thinking about where we're at as a nation, and I'm excited about your offer. I think it's great.
Now, can you tell us, and it could vary from individual to individual, but do you believe that reading the book will help reduce their generalized anxiety here in the era of Trump?
Yes. The reason it will reduce their general anxiety is that part of the anxiety is based on not knowing even how to think or being flooded by all of his lies and all of the attacks and how he can risk our alliances with NATO and with other countries and make us feel insecure and unsafe. And I really think that people need to be able to think and settle down and read and pay attention. A lot of people are angry at him, and a lot of people are afraid of him, and it's hard to think. And I really do think that the first act of resistance is to read. Oh. And that when you start reading, you can really start to think. And I think the book is really trying to organize things. So, like, for instance, one of the things that he does, for instance, is that Trump is a very anxious, agitated person. But what he's doing with his tweets, he is trying to make everybody else anxious. He tries to activate in other people. So I know a lot of people and patients in my practice who've had trouble sleeping since he became president, who've been more anxious than they can remember. They've been worried about all kinds of things that they didn't used to think about. But part of that is that he activates things inside people, but he also evacuates and pushes his anxiety into the rest of us. The shutdown, what he did to those government workers, and what he's done with separating mothers and children, those are things that make people anxious.
Well, Doctor,
but they're afraid. They're not going to get paid and not be. It makes people feel helpless.
He is a serial hostage taker. He started with the Dreamers by unilaterally revoking Obama's order related to DACA. When that didn't get his wall funded by Congress, he then expanded that to the family separation process at the border. And, then he decided to add some Haitians and Laotians and Cambodians who've been in this country for 10 to 20 years and just toss them into the hostage bin. And he keeps just building this group of people who are subject to his whim as he continues to use them as leverage to try to get his way.
It's trying to take power over a part of himself that feels inadequate, damaged, unable to read, unable to sit still, unable to think clearly, unable to make sense of what other people are saying, unable to understand everything from a security briefing from the CIA to an article in a newspaper or a book or anything. He cannot do it. And so he has had to constantly expand the people that he attacks, who are, in his view, weaker and lesser than him. And what he does, though, is he's always evacuating disavowed parts of himself. He was aware that he couldn't read. He knew he couldn't read. He knew he couldn't think clearly growing up. So he learned how to read other people and pay attention and look at their behavior, because he couldn't actually understand things unless he actually saw them. So I think that all of this stuff that you're talking about with the dreamers, he's attacking people who are thinking about, who are thinking, who are yearning, who want to do something. He can't stand it.
Yeah.
And he has to spoil it. He has to attack it. And it's quite dramatic. I mean, it's really, I mean, the shutdown is so amazing because it was his father who shut him down and sent him off.
Mm.
And so he is the active person. I mean, lying, one of the most interesting studies of lying, psychoanalytic studies of lying, for instance, are that people who lie, especially to the extent that Donald Trump does, originally started lying as a way of mocking their own parents, his own parents, who he felt lied to him as a young child when they said that they loved him. I really do think that he has been lying to everyone as a way of both mocking and being like his parents, like he felt his parents were. He's been repaying them ever since with his lying. Want me to show me about lying, Mother? I'll show you. This is a really good lie. And then she's even said a few times in interviews, in the one that Maureen Brenner wrote, I guess, Marie Brenner, in 94, that his mother said, "I can't believe I created a child like this, an adult like this, who lies and is so destructive. He cannot tell the truth. It is not an option."
Wow. Dr. Frank, before we wrap up, I want to touch on one of your final chapters, The Language of Donald Trump. And it is unique. It's often hard to quite figure out, not just Covfefe, but some of the bizarre things that he says. And let me lift a couple of quotes before you comment further. "Trump's language is more than simply idiosyncratic. It is the language of a salesman who conveys emotion that serves primarily to call attention to himself." And a page over, you say, "It has memorably been said that the voters considered collectively as Trump's base take his words seriously, but not literally. His opponents, on the other hand, at least initially, did the reverse, taking his words literally without taking them or Trump seriously." And another page, you write, "He circles around his original idea, which is something psychoanalysts call tangential thinking, a pattern of speech characterized by oblique, digressive, or irrelevant replies to a question." Expand a little bit on that, please.
Okay, tangential thinking is something that you see in certain kinds of people who cannot stay on point. So one of the things about his language difficulties is that he's not able to focus or stay on point. So what people who are tangential thinkers are is they think of something and it makes them think of something else and something else. They're all related, and why it's called tangential is that if you really took time to connect the dots, you could get to the original kernel that they were talking about. It's a form of associations and thought that leads further and further away and expands. He does that a lot, where he's thinking about something and then he says, like even the thing about on both sides. He probably was thinking about his father, who was very much like a Nazi at home. And so he says there are good people on both sides. It's a tangential thinking. What's important about it is that it's not psychotic, because people who are tangential thinkers can come back to the original point. People who are totally psychotic, which he is not, are not able to get back to the original point at all. They forget what they've been talking about, and they just go from one thing to the next.
Mm-hmm.
So tangential thinking are people who are related, are people who have grandiose fantasies because they just expand and blow up, and then everything, and then I did this, and then not only did I do this, I did this, and I did that. It's a form of grandiosity. It's a form of taking one little thing and making an entire, like if you look at one of those megaphone diagrams, just expanding out into into the world.
Well, I'm going to take this and apply it, because as I read it, Dr. Frank, I thought, well, what you're really describing, I perceive as his dodging the question, that
yes.
he's looking for nine different ways to respond without actually answering.
Yes. Tangential thinking is also a defense. It's not only it's grandiose, but it's also a way of dodging a question by flooding other people and by constantly staying away from it. But they still keep a little kernel of connection to the original thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they go outside of it more and more and more and more and expand it more and more and more and more as a way of dodging a question. It's a way of not ever being able to be pinned down.
And here's another priceless
Nixon
quote.
Nixon was great at that, by the way.
Yes, he was. Here's another priceless quote from your book. Beyond tangential thought patterns, Trump's syntax frequently demonstrates a range of particular and now familiar characteristics, ranging from dishonest content, lying, inciting, polarization or violence, mocking, exaggerated promises, self-reference, to a disjointed style marked by the repetition of phrases, the use of adjectives and adverbs as nouns, and clang associations, which define words and phrases by how they sound when their actual meaning is either unknown or something else.
Right. So, for instance, that's very common in children, clang associations, because they think about the most basic meaning. So when Amy Klobuchar, whatever I pronounce her last name, better get used to it, announced yesterday, she told the story about a Somali family where these people came to, they were eating in a restaurant, and some people came up to them and said, "Get home right now. You get out of here and go home." And this little girl says to her mother, I thought you said we could eat out tonight. I don't want to eat at home." So home to her meant where she lived. Home to the people who were attacking her meant to go back to Somalia.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an example of, in a kid, of clang association, the word home. They take the biggest, most common meaning of it, and they can't turn it into a metaphor or into talking about something else. Trump does that all the time.
Yeah.
And he's constantly making associations and thoughts. He does two things. That's one thing in his language, which is clang association. The second thing is that he has a very limited vocabulary, and he is unable to describe things in any kind of detail. So he uses the word great.
Mm-hmm.
People who don't read and people who can't read have a very limited ability to describe things. They just can't do it. It's much harder because you don't have the vocabulary, you don't have the sentence structure and the ability to put thoughts and ideas together. But so what he ends up is doing something that's very meaningless when he says, "I want to thank my parents who are great. They're great people." And he talks about all these different things. This one is a tremendous person.
Right.
This one's a great person.
And he's a disaster.
He's a disaster. That's why this book is valuable. You just helped me. It's valuable because it doesn't just say he's a disaster. It helps you think about the ways in which he's a disaster so you can start defining them and making sense of them and putting them together so you get a fuller picture of who he is. Whereas he just says, you know, so-and-so is a disaster. So-and-so is trying to screw us out of treaties or whatever they're
mm-hmm.
doing. So he really suffers from this subtype that I think was undetected when he was a child that has to do with processing words and processing language. And it wasn't only that he had trouble reading, he had trouble processing meaning, which is why they've given up on giving briefings to him. It's not because he's impatient, that's part of it, but he's impatient because he can't understand. So if you don't understand something, what are you going to do? You're just going to get unable to sit still and want to, you know, do something else. It's very hard.
Well, Dr. Frank, your new book, Trump on the Couch, is full of interesting information and analysis. I learned a lot from it. The last thing I'd like to get your comment on is this repetitive process where Trump is always framing things around who likes him and just how likable he is. And so Kim Jong-un writes him love letters, and it's because Kim likes Trump. And, you know, he has a great relationship with Xi Jinping, and he's destroyed China's economy and is working on ours with his tariff war. And most importantly, Putin thinks he's a genius. So what is it that he needs so much adulation and reinforcement?
I don't know why I don't talk to you every week, because you always make me think better. Here is something that you're saying that really is important, because I would to link with the lying. He lies because he was lied to. He never felt he was loved. He never felt his parents loved him, so he's been lying to other people as a way of mocking their lying. But the other part one has to do is to compensate for not feeling loved, you have to love yourself. And you have to be the person who loves yourself more than anybody else. And we all need some self-love and some self-respect. But he goes to the nth degree, and he constantly needs reassurance that people love him and they care about him. But what you made me think about was that the only person he can imagine really loving him is a person who was like him, which is a tyrant, which is a dictator. So he feels affinity for dictators because he, inside, is a dictator. He wants to control everything, every thought, everything that's going on. So when Kim Jong-un writes him a letter, he is in love with him because he is. It's a form of self-love that's projected, the dictator part of him, projected onto a real dictator, literally, who then loves him. The same with Putin, with all these other people. It's being loved by a person who's like you, like him, like himself.
The book is Trump on the Couch, Inside the Mind of the President. We've been visiting with Dr. Justin A. Frank, a Washington, D.C.-based psychiatrist. Justy, I always learn a lot from our conversations and your books, and I look forward to further therapy.
Me too.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview and therapy session with Dr. Justin A. Frank. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.